This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
You might already know the history of Apollo 13. There's a Tom Hanks movie if you don't. On April 11th, 1970, 55 hours and 55 minutes into its three-man mission to the moon, there was an explosion on board. Two of the vessel's three fuel cells were lost. The mission was finished, and it seemed impossible that the three astronauts would ever come home. Against the odds, NASA's finest worked on the ground to improvise a rescue. Using incredible resourcefulness and organisation, and with the astronauts' own knowledge of their craft, the three men made it safely back to Earth. The commander of Apollo 13 was James A. Lovell. By the way, if you want your child to be an astronaut, you'd better give them a middle initial. It was during that mission that Lovell spoke to ground control in Texas the now famous words, "Houston, we've had a problem." Except those words aren't quite the famous ones, even though they're what Lovell actually said. The movie, and most people who use the phrase in everyday life, improve that quote to, "Houston, we have a problem." You can see why. "Houston, we have a problem" implies, "Houston, we've just found out we've got a problem. Oh no, what are we going to do about it? We're trying not to panic here." "Houston, we've had a problem" is altogether more professional and controlled. That says to me, "Houston, something unfortunate has occurred and I'm radioing it in so we can work together to determine the best and most sensible course of action." What a difference a tense makes. It's always pleasing when a good line's made great. For movies, the present tense is, of course, more dramatic than the past. But in the history of Apollo 13, the less flashy quote, the less quotable quote, is the truer one. Because Houston had had the problem for much longer than they knew. It was only now, in the heat of the mission, that it had become dangerously apparent. But the source of the problem happened as far back as 1965. Now that's an explosion with a 5-year-long fuse. It was tiny. Some design engineers made a minor change to the power supplies. Somehow this small change in voltage never filtered down to other people working on the mission, and this was the first link in an invisible chain of mistakes. Commander Lovell might more appropriately, although to a diminished dramatic effect, have said, "Houston, we've had a problem for 5 years and have just found out about it now." For a theatre director, this is a horror story. The idea that what you are embarked on is born to fail because of a tiny, invisible fault would keep you awake at night. Actually, it would keep you completely out of a rehearsal room. The Apollo 13 moment has happened to me just once. Coincidentally, it was also an engineering problem. I was directing Twelfth Night in Chicago. The designer and I had conceived a production of the play set on a decaying and waterlogged pier. At its greatest depth, the tank in which the pier sat went as far as 7 feet of water. At the beginning, when Viola entered from the shipwreck, she came through the air on a wire and disappeared into the water to be rescued by the sea captain. Liminal, poetic, terrific. We were very pleased with our idea. Except the scenic builders had miscalculated the pressure that the water would exert on the sides of the tank, and the first time it was filled, 7,000 gallons of water flooded through the basement of the Chicago Shakespeare Theatre. Not a great moment. Well, no one was hurt. They rebuilt the tank, correctly, and the set won an award. In a way, those kind of problems are the easiest to deal with. No one on the show is directly responsible. The catastrophe, once it has occurred, becomes, like Apollo 13, a race against time. Time constraints we can deal with. They are meat and drink to us. Theatre's all about deadlines. We solved the Twelfth Night problem by completing the technical rehearsal for the show in half the time, thus giving them time to build and install a new tank. We rescued the mission, but sometimes that just isn't possible. There have been shows I've directed where the problem has been so buried and so tangible, it can't help but come to the surface and destroy the show. I was talking to a theatre critic recently. He was saying, rather compassionately, that theatre directors can receive bad reviews for mistakes in productions that are beyond their control, and that always seems to him to be unfair. I said, rather stoically, that it was an occupational hazard, and we all find different ways to insure ourselves against the risk. So often, the choices we make in preparation for the rehearsal room predetermine the outcome. Even now that I am more experienced, the idea of a small and hidden problem waiting 5 years to create a catastrophe is profound. What haven't I thought of is the question that keeps me awake the night before I begin rehearsals. All of the choices that we make in our preparation for the rehearsal room and for the stage require an act of imagination that sees the show and hears the audience respond months before the opening performance. In our minds, we have to infer the stage sets from a scale model, setting from tatty rehearsal room props, and the performance you'll get from the actors you audition, if that is, they have auditioned and you haven't just offered the part to them. That's why our collaborators, such as designers, lighting designers, casting directors, actors, become so important. They bring a level of engagement and expertise about the process and about us as directors that reassures us. One of my closest collaborators is the theatre designer Lucy Osborne. She and I have this exercise that we do at the end of rehearsal days. We ask ourselves, what's going to go wrong? And try to imagine all the points at which the production is vulnerable. It's a great exercise, and it helps you to confront things that you can see coming and rationalise what you're asking of people. I like to think that my unnatural obsession with problems has a rational basis. I see problems as a part of my job. Anticipating, solving, confronting tricky situations is one of the great unspoken parts of the directing craft. Why one show succeeded and another flopped is regarded by many as alchemy. To me, it's a kind of anatomy. I've got it wrong many times, and every time I have, there has been something absorbed that will, hopefully, insulate me against repeating that moment. As an artistic director, those questions are really profound. They can go back as far as the choice of whether or not to program a play. With a new play, the question of whether or not you should ask for a rewrite or trust that they will fix it in the rehearsal room. The more you can do before you get to a rehearsal room, the better. But as someone once said, if literary managers had existed in Shakespeare's day, he would still be at his desk rewriting the fourth act of Measure for Measure. Sometimes we have to trust that things will be solved in the act of putting them on. As a young director, I was offered a production of Romeo and Juliet in Liverpool. At that time, I was assisting Peter Gill, one of our most brilliant directors. He gave me a great piece of advice. Start with the fights and the dances, dear. Too many directors leave them until the last moment and then they're scuppered. You must always begin with the thing you're the most afraid of, and then, when you've done that, everyone feels better and you can begin to work. Genius. Except that production went horribly wrong. With hindsight, I realised that the theatre that asked a very inexperienced director to stage a major Shakespeare was probably a theatre that needed to take a close look at itself. There were too many unhappy people backstage, too many people in fear of their jobs for that ever to be a happy show. One night, the crew tried to walk, and the actors insisted on performing the show in working light. There were a couple of shows I did at the beginning of my career where the quality of my mistakes was so high, mistakes so great and so particular, they have informed everything I've done subsequently. I think that was probably one of them. In my early 20s, I trained as an assistant director at the Donmar Warehouse in Covent Garden. Now I'm preparing to take over as the theatre's artistic director. While training, I saw for the first time an actor completely explode in a rehearsal. There was shouting and crying. There might even have been something thrown. It's actually an urban myth that actors do this kind of thing all the time. It's surprisingly rare and happens not much more often, I imagine, than in the average bank, supermarket or football team. Perhaps it's satirised more readily when actors lose it because they're generally doing so about a job which involves pretending to be someone else. So the accusation of taking it all too seriously immediately follows. Anyway, I digress. This incident. What was fascinating to me is that the actor was standing in the middle of the stage, making a huge row about the shoes she'd been given to wear. She was listing why she couldn't possibly walk on stage wearing these shoes, how they were utterly wrong, would ruin her entire performance, and so on and so on. But the thing I remember my 23-year-old self thinking very clearly was, it's not the shoes, is it? She was, in fact, unhappy with the performance and felt like she was failing the part. Of course, the shoes were changed and the actor soothed, but the problem resurfaced in other ways during the run of the production. The question, and it's always a great one, is do you deal with the shoes or with the real problem? Sometimes, tackling everything that you can see can lead to a degree of unravelling that leaves the whole thing in bits. It's not just about foreseeing it. It's about knowing when to call it. Because the circumstances are temporary and the stakes so high, people enter the rehearsal process with a heightened state of expectation. One of the biggest shocks I received upon becoming an artistic director is realising that the people who worked in permanent jobs in the theatre were just that, permanent. The expectations, the engagement, the benefits even, are much longer term. When you start rehearsing a play, you do so with the same feeling of heady optimism and new encounter that you do a love affair. It's essentially a romantic experience. And when it goes wrong, the sense of betrayal is not dissimilar. Where were you? You weren't listening. You promised me. I thought that we were in this together. Is there something else you want that I can't give you? I remember once as a young director being hugely flattered when a handsome actor I was directing bounded into rehearsals one morning and told me that he had had a dream about me the previous night. Oh yes, I responded, with inappropriate blushes. Yes, he replied, you stabbed me in the head. That was the last time I ever let an actor tell me his dream. The technical faults we can deal with. Expectation curdling to betrayal is that much harder. We all head off to the moon in the expectation of returning to Earth. Sometimes our failures are where we make our greatest discoveries and strongest friends. Learning the language of failure is as important as finding out how to succeed. And only those closest to us, and most expert in both, can bring us safely back to Earth.